Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
We need to cross over to a man that his career has taken him from the Federal Reserve to the IMF and Citigroup somewhere in between. Bill Lee, Milken Institute Chief Economist. William Lee joins us now. William, great to catch up with you, sir. Walk us through the effect of a hurricane this size on the US economy. We've kind of been through this before. Just set us up for what could come and how the data could change over the coming quarters.
We have, but this is such a historic proportion, right? I mean, it seems as though the hurricane sizes and intensity have gone up over the years. And what's different about this one is that it's striking a place that normally gets hurricanes, but not as frequently as, say, Florida. Florida is very accustomed to that, and I think they have infrastructure and they're well set up. The people are used to dealing with this. North Carolina gets one in a couple of decades, and so this is where the tragedy may be, that people just don't take the warnings to heed. And then the follow-up, though, is that the disaster that takes place is always followed by the rebuilding, and that's where the data would show some surge in activity, especially for construction. And so that in some ways will do some good for the statistics over the next quarter or so beyond the hurricane. But the tragedy is something that certainly will not be made up for by that extra activity.
I've got to say, the data this morning that we've had in the U.S. economy, wow, just a wow number from the U.S. small business optimism read. Bill, I don't know if you saw it, but it is the highest since tracking began in 1974. It's exceeded the prior peak back in September 1983. Is this a boom economy now, Bill?
Well, no question it's a boom economy. The question is, will it continue? And that surge in small business, I think, is a really good sign because it's followed up by real actions. Small businesses have been taking out loans. They have been expanding their businesses. They've been trying to hire people. And that means that this has legs, and as opposed to just soft data that goes away and turns around very quickly.
Billy, you know, I haven't brought it up yet, but here we are 15 days away from September 26. If we're seeing this boom economy, why can't the Fed do an Arthur Burns and do more than a quarter of a point rate increase? Are they really wedded to this measured Greenspanian approach?
Well, they made the markets accustomed to that, right? But I think what you're going to see at the turn of the year is that because Powell has announced a press conference every meeting, you're going to start seeing, I suspect, the capacity to front load a lot of these rate increases. And that's what I'm anticipating.
John, I think, John,
if the data really show up to be as strong going into January, February, we're going to have more than just one every other meeting.
John, I think this is a huge deal.
Yeah,
I agree
with
this whole new press conference. I mean, I don't know what McKee thinks, but to me, it's a huge deal.
We can get Mike's view on it later. I think the subcomponents of the NFIB survey this morning were just amazing, as Bill pointed out. Job creation plans, unfilled job openings, new records. When we start having this conversation about where does wage growth come from, I mean, the data just keeps spelling it out, Bill. We must be close to that moment. And I feel like we've been saying that for so long, but the data just keeps screaming it, doesn't it?
John, the one thing that I think most commentators are overlooking, including your guests, is that because we've had a lot of investment, firms are substituting capital for labor. They don't need to hire as much because they're building the machines to do more and make labor more productive. What they're not doing is giving increases in real wage to match the potential increase in productivity. That's going into profit margins, and that in some ways is feeding that stock market boom that we've all been experiencing.
Yeah. Bill, one more question. We mentioned this earlier, but I think it needs a redux. What's the gradient here towards a normal economy? Is it a gradient to early 2019, or can this economy feed on itself and stay sustained?
You know, I think I'm not a supply sider. I've never been in my professional life, but I'm starting to see the impact of the greater investment taking hold and being able to give us a glide path where we are starting to see above trend growth for longer and longer. Remember, hysteresis is a word that was always the European economies, right? But now we know hysteresis applies to the U.S. And as we grow faster and faster, potential growth is also going to start growing faster and faster.
And good morning to Olivier Blanchard with his important essay a few days ago, and Lawrence Summers for their academic work on sustained unemployment. William Lee with us with the Milken Institute. Thank you. We get an Apple update. We felt it was important to look at these market leaders in Amazon and Apple, and we can do that with Walter Pisek of BTIG. Walter, thy hold sell. Where are you right now on Apple?
The stock has obviously been performing well, as it typically does, ahead of an iPhone launch. I would warn people that the day of the launch itself, which I guess is expected tomorrow or the announcement, the stock doesn't typically fare that well. But rather than being focused on the near term, just looking at the long term, or at least the intermediate term prospects of earnings growth for the company, that's the reason to buy the stock.
Have you done a sum of the parts analysis? Have you actually tried to figure out what services/iTunes is actually worth, or the core franchise is worth, or the peripheral is worth? Have you done a sum of the parts?
We haven't done that yet, Tom, but it's interesting because it's so early stage. If you look at the number of, let's say, active iPhone users that are out there, Creative Strategies estimates that about 800 million, 850 million. There's only 300 million people today that are paying as a regular subscription. So we're still early days in terms of the number of customers paying regular service fees. And then those service fees themselves, per customer, which in the service industry that's called ARPU, can probably go up as they layer on new opportunities. And once we get more visibility on that and see a better understanding of the margins on that, then you can think about that in terms of a true service company, 15, 20 EBITDA-type margins.
John, I just want you to know that we're really switching to Apple TV at home.
And
the sign-up for the service industries, as Mr. Pisek puts it, is the small value of an island GDP
Interesting.
Nation.
Interesting.
Yes.
Walter, we spoke to a value investor yesterday who considers Apple to be value, which is interesting because they have this really growthy services business. And I think the continued sort of complication among some investors is to understand what kind of multiple to apply to this business, this company. Where is that multiple, Walter, in your mind?
Well, for years we've talked about this as a value name because it's been a discount to the S&P 500, but now we've kind of caught up to that, right? It's more a parity. So then you're saying, okay, if it's growing faster than the market and the margins are high and sustainable, then that could argue for some type of premium to wherever the market multiple or the S&P 500 is trading at the moment. And look, part of the earnings growth, let's be clear, is the amount of cash that they have, and cash generation enables them to buy a lot of stock back. So that turns what might look like low growth of net income into double-digit earnings growth.
So there's kind of like two halves to the Apple year. The first half is when we get a real sort of understanding of the buyback program, and the second half is the product range. What's the most important half right now, Walter?
Well, right now, going in to see what this what these new products are going to look like, and what other, at least what the new iPhones will look like, and what they're going to do, and what other products are going to get refreshed. To me, the larger issue, though, is we're coming off multiple years where people have been holding on to their smartphones and their iPhones longer than they ever have, and that could inflect. So the iPhone unit growth really hasn't changed much in the past 3 years. They've relied heavily on getting you to pay more for iPhones that you're buying.
I didn't know that.
I mean, if you went back to 2015, we probably sold more iPhones in 2015 than we did in 2018. So a lot of times people are trying to craft a negative thesis saying, like, oh, the iPhone's not growing anymore. I'm like, okay, well, that thesis is about 3 years old.
Well, believe me, so, Tom Key knows.
Stop it.
Key knows because
Walter,
he paid upfront cash for his iPhone 10.
John, VetBill has an iPhone 10.
VetBill has a higher ASP, that's for sure. Walter, what is the ASP situation at the moment, and what do you expect the new product mix to do when it's launched tomorrow? Do we get an ASP lift?
Well, 5 years ago, the ASP was about $600. Now we're paying $750 for our phone. So we may not get the same lift going forward that we did this year with the launch of the iPhone X. But again, we've had multiple years where people, the life cycle has extended. So if the life cycle stops extending, if people start upgrading their phones just a little bit more, you're going to get some level of unit growth, maybe some ASP growth.
Right.
Okay, so even if the iPhone business is just sustaining and generating a ton of free cash flow at those high margins,
right,
then we can get back to how you started out with the services business growing 20%.
Walter, I don't have the equation in front of me. Taylor Riggs has it memorized because she just passed the CFA. But the annuity function is different than the normal revenue function. How close is Apple to where the sell side has to start doing the annuity math of those monthly payments everybody's paying, where we go from revenue from lump sum purchase to where we're all up on monthly plans that read like an insurance contract.
I mean, several years ago, there were some investors that were pushing Apple to move to that and saying Apple should charge $50 a month and just give the customer the ability to upgrade their phone every couple
of
years.
Well, isn't that what I'm doing, except it's not $50 a month. I got eight phones. I mean, vet bills fee alone is $42 a month.
Absolutely. And conceptually, that's the way people should look at it, because iPhone customers are very loyal and they come back to the same phone, you know, every
couple of years. But is the sell side figuring in the value, the terminal value of that annuity equation?
That has definitely not happened yet, because if it did, then the multiple relative to where the market is, if people looked at this as a recurring revenue business or an annuity business at the high margins that they're generating, would probably get a higher value than it does in the market today.
What you just heard there, folks, and I don't have an opinion, buy, hold, sell, but John Farrell, what Mr. Pisak just said there is critical mathematics.
Significant. Walter, final question for you. Trade. The company's come out in the last week and said that tariffs are going to hit the prices of a range of products. Do you see this as material, or does this just shape some of the mood music?
I mean, look, I think there's a lot of consumer-like product, electronic products that have lower margins that are going to be more impacted if they have to increase price. At least Apple's got some excessive margins that they can use if they choose to cushion the blow. And it would happen if they did increase prices based on some of these tariffs. It would happen at a time when everyone knows, and they wouldn't take a brand hit from just increasing the prices on their customer. But the other thing to consider is, look, a lot of consumers may look at this and say this might be just kind of near-term threatening and jawboning by these countries, and they could delay some purchases as people wait for price increases to fade, and thinking that it would be a near-term impact on their prices, and then after the trade war was resolved, that maybe they could go back to a cheaper price. And you could have some push out of purchases if a situation like that occurred. And again, this is not for iPhones, right? A lot of these things that were labeled are things like the AirPods and some of the accessory products, as opposed to the core product for Apple.
Walter Pisak, great to catch up with you ahead of that product launch tomorrow. Walter Pisak, BTIG,
yeah,
research analyst and managing director.
I am here with my co-host and colleague, Lisa Abramowitz.
Hi, Tim.
Always great to be with you.
Couldn't,
to have you
couldn't
here.
Stay away.
Thank you. Let's bring in Margie Patel right now, Managing Director, Senior Portfolio Manager for Wells Capital Management. Margie Patel, let's talk about high-yield debt right now. What's the outlook for high-yield debt, given this sort of back and forth with interest rates, and now we see pressure on emerging markets? What happens to high-yield debt when that money tries to find another home?
Well, I think U.S. Domestic high-yield market looks in tremendous shape. It's reflected in the very low defaults, less than 2%, an extra yield advantage of around 3.5 percentage points, which is near the narrow, shows you there's no stress. I think the market is clearly identifying the risk in emerging market bonds versus U.S. Very little effect.
Okay, so very little effect. Stay focused on the United States. Does this also mean that earnings for U.S. companies are rising faster than interest rates?
Yes, they have been, and I expect that they will continue. So that means a pretty positive backdrop for equities. At the margin, some companies may feel, as we go into next year, a little bit of diminution in their cash flow, because most of the emerging markets have a growth rate much lower than the U.S. growth rate.
You know, one thing that I'm struck by, especially as short-term yields in the U.S. rise to new post-crisis highs today ahead of the auctions later today and later this week, I have to wonder, you know, is the Fed raising rates too quickly or too slowly at this point? And how does that affect your view of markets? And I say this because Bob Dimon, the former head of Barclays, spoke with Francine Lacroix of Bloomberg Television this morning and was saying that he is really concerned that the Fed hasn't raised rates faster, creating less ammunition for them during the next downturn. How did coming in this? I mean, do you think that's the case?
I think that's looking at the history books, looking at past cycles, rather than looking at the fundamental changes in the financial market for this credit cycle. Number one, the Fed is very transparent in what they're doing. Number two, we really don't see the classic inflation pressure we saw in other cycles. The fact that our yield curve is almost flat doesn't bother me at all. It isn't the signal of credit tightness we used to see. And when you look at other measures of tightness and liquidity, whether it's high-yield bonds, like we just talked about, or in what bank lending officers are doing, cutting back on loans, we just aren't seeing it. So I'd say they're doing it just about right.
Margie, in your expertise with the world of bonds, one of the funds that you help manage, the Wells Fargo Diversified Capital Fund, that has really performed well. It's up 7.5% so far this year. It's aggressive. Do you believe that that will continue to outperform some of the other less aggressive conservative funds?
Well, I consider that fund actually a conservative fund in the style that I've been managing it. It's taken advantage of what market is cheaper, the bond market, especially high yield or equities. And I think equities will continue to outperform bonds over, say, the next 6 months, in particular, maybe the next 12 months.
All right. So going forward, I guess I'm wondering, given the fact that we are seeing weakness in emerging markets and it has not bled over to the high yield bond market, given the fact that you think that the U.S. is strong and that the Federal Reserve is raising rates at an appropriate rate, where is the best risk adjusted return right now, in your opinion?
In common stocks of U.S. companies continues to be the best place to be. And also looking at growth, it used to be emerging markets. The case for that was they were growing so much faster, two or three times faster than the U.S. Now the U.S. is actually one of the strongest growing economies in the world.
Yeah.
And most emerging markets are slogging along either recession or very low single digit levels. So that says to me that's where the best opportunity is.
Margie, do you think that a lot of riskier corporate debt investors right now have just become stock investors?
No, I don't. I think that looking at the bond market intrinsically looks very good. We aren't seeing a lot of supply. And by the way, supply is down compared to the peaks of the last couple of years ago. We're not seeing companies borrow money in the junk bond market for crazy purposes. Over half of what they're borrowing is to refinance other debt, improve their balance sheet. And like investment-grade companies, they also have a pretty good cash flow outlook.
We're speaking with Margie Patel, Managing Director, Senior Portfolio Manager for Wells Capital Management. In just a few moments, we will be going to the Pentagon to take a moment of silence in observance of the time that American Airlines Flight 77 struck the Pentagon. Vice President Pence, as well as Secretary of Defense Mattis, are there. And just quickly, Margie, is there a risk that we're not paying attention to right now?
I think in the U.S., the risks are pretty low for the equity market and for the economy as a whole. I think there's risk in the emerging market. How soon that might come and impact the U.S., I think, is something we can't really say at this point, if in fact it does have a big negative effect.
I want to thank you very much for spending time with us. Margie Patel is Managing Director, Senior Portfolio Manager for Wells Capital Management. Our next guest is most appropriate for this day. He is the former governor of New Jersey, Tom Keene. He is perhaps more widely known around the world as the chairman of the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks Upon the United States. It's more informally known as the 9/11 Commission, Tom Keene. Governor Keene, thank you very much for being with us. You were appointed by President George W. Bush, and you served as the chairman of the 9/11 Commission. What can you tell us, based on your experience, what do you believe has changed in order to battle these kinds of threats, not only in the United States, but around the world?
Well, we've made a lot of progress. We had three basic recommendations on the 9/11 Commission. One basically was that we had to go after the terrorists where they were. They had a sanctuary in Afghanistan that couldn't be allowed to exist, so we went after them there. Second and most important recommendation was we had to harden our defenses, because we made so many mistakes leading up to 9/11 to let those people come to the United States, travel freely around the United States, plot and plan, and eventually pull off 9/11 was terrible. And so we had to harden our defenses so it would never happen again. And a third recommendation was to start preventing terrorism where it starts. And that's the one we haven't done. I mean, we did the first two. I mean, we made recommendations and the Congress adopted them to really strengthen the homeland. And we haven't had any major attacks in the United States since then. But what we didn't do, and that's what this commission I'm now involved with is recommending, is go to the fragile states of the Middle East and the Horn of Africa where these terrorists thrive and where they come from and see if we can prevent terrorism there. Because if we can do that, then we'll be much safer in the homeland.
What kind of tactics would be involved in such an enterprise?
Well, we've now spent a lot of money, billions of dollars, a lot of it militarily. A lot of those countries we're talking about, we've got troops there now. Others, we're aiding their armed forces, and it's not ineffective, but it's not really solving the problem. These states have governments which are not helpful to the people. They can't often provide basic services like water supply and sewerage and that kind of thing. Moreover, they're often corrupt, and the people have no faith in their governments. And you know, you got to have hope. You really have to have hope. And if there's no hope, that's where terrorism thrives. And that's what we've seen in these states. So what we're suggesting is a whole new approach to our work in that area, where we get together with our allies, where we have a concerted strategy to really make sure they're not breeding grounds for the kind of terrorists that someday are going to want to attack this country again.
Now, you're going to be honored at a ceremony today at which former Representative Lee Hamilton, as well as the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, will attend. And do you believe that the national intelligence infrastructure of the United States is in sympathy with what you're just described?
Yeah, we've been trying to keep everybody. First of all, we're congressionally mandated. This came out of Congress, led by Lindsey Graham and others, to suggest this task force and address this problem. So we come out of Congress. But I've been talking, Lee Hamilton has too, to a number of people in the administration and the intelligence operation, and we've been encouraged. I mean, they've said, yes, you're on the right track, you're doing the right thing. We want to consider what you come up with very seriously. So we've had encouragement both from the Congress and from the administration, and we think this is one of the few things in Washington that is really bipartisan. I mean, there are no Republicans and no Democrats on this one. It's keeping us safer. So we have high hopes to get everybody together behind these recommendations.
Well, Governor Kaine, is someone that brought up the topic of bipartisanship, and wonder if you could expand on that and speak about your political experience and how to build bipartisan agreement, at least on some things.
Well, first of all, you've got to do that for the big things, for the important things, like the war against terror. And my own experience is, frankly, has been bipartisan. I was speaker of a legislature which had no majority. Neither Republicans or Democrats had a majority, and they elected me, and I had to work with both parties. When I was elected governor for 8 years, I had a Democratic state senate. And we either worked together or nothing got done. And we worked together and shared the traffic, and shared the credit, rather, and got a lot done. And so my whole, and the 9/11 commission, of course, was, some people say, was the last truly bipartisan important thing that's been done in this country. Because we were unanimous in our recommendations. It was 5 Republicans and 5 Democrats. We worked together in the interest of the country. So I think it can be done. It takes trust. It takes the idea, which I always realized, that, you know, you can be a Republican or a Democrat, but you probably ran for office for the right reason. You know, you really want to help the country. And if you recognize that other fellow wants to help the country too, even though he has a D in his name instead of an R, you can work together.
Having said that, I'm sure that you have had an occasion to watch the nomination hearings for Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. What was your reaction to the back and forth between Republicans and Democrats?
Well, frankly, I was appalled because, you know, Supreme Court is something that ought to be treated with utmost dignity, and it just wasn't. And we've got to get back to that. We got to get back to the idea that, you know, of course a Republican president has a right to nominate a Republican, a Democratic president has a right to nominate a Democrat. And if those people are qualified, they ought to be treated with the utmost dignity, as befits the highest court in the land. And my hope is we'll get back to that. I mean, I think there are a lot of people of goodwill in the Congress, and if they want to get anything done, really, and they have to get things done for all our interests, then they got to find a way to talk to each other in a civil manner and operate the way our Congress has operated in for years until the present time.
Do you have any thoughts on how elections operate? And I'm speaking now about campaign contributions and how that has contributed to the hostile atmosphere that exists.
Money has been the cancer in the system, in my mind. I mean, I don't. I just think we've got to find a way to control these contributions and at least make sure that every contribution is visible, so that we as voters know who's supporting who and by how much, and then we can judge their actions accordingly. But I think we've got to, we've got to do that. We've got to let Congress get to know each other better. You know, years ago, congressmen used to work 5-6 days a week, and they and their families lived in Washington, and they all got to know each other. You know, if your spouses know each other and your children know each other, it's very hard to be enemies. You know, you become friends. And so there are a number of things we have to do. Campaign finance reform is certainly one of them.
Now, you were previously the president of Drew University. You were there for 15 years.
Yeah.
And free speech, or at least debating free speech on college campuses, is a topic. And indeed, some people have been barred from speaking at various college campuses because of the potential for disagreement. What are your thoughts?
Well, the university stands for just the opposite. The university, ideally, in this country, stands for all ideas and the airing of all ideas. And you know, students should not be kept, can't be kept safe from ideas. You know, whether they're right-wing ideas or left-wing ideas, the students ought to be able to consider them and listen to them on their own campus. And so I'm just very, very much against any campus of any kind which keeps any speaker off that campus. Students ought to be allowed to debate freely and hear freely and all opinions. And it's not a decent university to me if they're banning speakers.
And just finally, Governor Kaine, your reflection on 9/11 as we await the next moment of silence. Give you about 30 seconds. What are your thoughts? What would you like to leave us with?
Well, I think about the families. I think about the people who lost so much, and the fact that those families, so many of them, have now dedicated themselves to keeping us safer. They're supporting the efforts I'm doing now on fragile states, and they're also supporting everything else to keep this country safer. They're wonderful, wonderful people, and I think about them on this day.
Thank you very much for joining us. Former governor of New Jersey, Tom Kaine, who's also the chairman of the 9/11 Commission, speaking about politics and efforts to forestall future terrorist attacks.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Kaine. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.